Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Daniel Schwartz. He's the Frederick J. Whiten Professor of English Literature and the Stephen H. Weiss Presidential Fellow at Cornell University, and the author of End Times, Crises and Turmoil at the New York Times, 1999 to 2009. He's also a blogger for the Huffington Post. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the title of the book. It suggests the possibility, and I say possibility because the word end times is followed by a question mark in your title, of an apocalyptic future for the newspaper and journalism more generally. So I was wondering if you could say a bit about that possibility, and then later I imagine we'll get into some of the reasons behind that possibility.
Well, the suggestion in the question mark is really whether the Times will survive. But that has a two-pronged aspect, because one could say whether it will survive as a print newspaper and whether it will survive as a news gathering operation. And there's even a third aspect, whether it will survive as a private company under the current ownership. As a news gathering operation, it probably will survive. We will always need to have somebody tell us what's going on. My conclusion about whether it survived as a newspaper is that in the foreseeable future, it will survive. It's sort of the last man standing. Most of the newspapers have radically cut their staff, and the New York Times has cut its staff 25%. But it towers over in its numbers any other newspaper. Now, the question is, will it survive as a news-gathering force? And I think that will go beyond the foreseeable future, that in some way, it could maybe be not as a private company, but more on the model of BBC, it will survive as a news-gathering operation. But with the onset of the Internet and 24-hour news, the Times is doing something radically different from what it once did. The Times was the paper of record. The Times created a daily history, which historians look back there to find out what was happening. And what does it do now? Well, it does several things better than other people, or it tries to. Well, first of all, it provides analysis. They have very smart people who do the op-ed pages and even do within the news pages various kinds of analysis. It does something they call enterprise journalism and I call investigatory journalism. For example, the Long Island Railroad scandal of a few summers ago. It was discovered by the Times that 100% of the Long Island Railroad conductors were on disability. And they followed some of these people around, and they found out that some of them were running triathlons and playing tennis every day. And they found out, too, that certain doctors were responsible for giving them this designation. And so they have the resources to allot several people to do this and to follow a story like this, even if it takes them months to gather that. They're the only newspaper that really has that kind of resources. The third thing that they do now is what we call value-added journalism or life journalism. Some years ago, they had one page a week for things like furniture, fur, fashion, and now they do that every day in these special sections. The Times is doing a lot of sort of human resource work. They tell you how to take care of your elderly parents and how to invest your money and, of course, where to travel. And there's one news-gathering thing that they do in America that nobody else does, and that's foreign affairs. You may see Anderson Cooper on the tarmac, but the Times is the only U.S. media source that does in-depth coverage in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and Pakistan. And one of the problems the Times has financially, and that speaks to that first question, will it survive, is nobody shares the cost of this. The major media, the major networks, the cable networks, the other news sources, other major newspapers, nobody does this foreign reporting. The Huffington Post, Politico, no one. So basically this material is stolen or used. And for the Times to survive, I believe some of this has to be shared, and some way has to be found for people to share this expense. The Washington Post, which is conceivably the second best newspaper in this country, has always had the convenient fiction that the way to do foreign news was to interview the ambassadors in Washington and at the UN. So they never put their resources into foreign news.
One of the many positive reviews of the book has the following sentence. This is a lover's quarrel at its best. And you've just told me, I think, many of the things that you love about the paper, the foreign affairs strength, the investigative journalism, the analysis, the value-added journalism. I was wondering if you could tell me now the things about the paper currently that drive you mad.
Well, there are, first of all, the Times has made many major errors over the last 13 years. From the accusation that Wan Ho Lee was an atomic spy, which may or may not have been true, but they didn't have the evidence, to the claims of weapons of mass destruction, which certainly enabled moderate Republicans, when there was such a thing, and moderate Democrats to vote for the war. So that was, they've had some major embarrassments. And I think, obviously, Jason Blair's scandal, that is forging articles, plagiarizing articles, this was not good. And they had egg on their face during the lacrosse, the Duke lacrosse scandal, too. The Duke lacrosse players may not have behaved admirably, but much of what they were accused of was untrue. I mean, I do conclude, and I should say so, that the Times is the worst newspaper in the world except for all the others. So it is, in some ways, a lover's quarrel.
A Churchillian defense.
Right, exactly. But there's a lot of what I call Times light and even Times trash. In other words, you know, they want to be au courant, so they write stuff about pornography sometimes, or they write for that section, what I call Times trash, or they, you know, they write about the mob or something like that. They try stuff that, or they give minor celebrities a great deal of attention. So some of that is, you know, the Times needs to know it's not the Rolling Stone.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Dan Schwartz, Cornell professor of English and the author of End Times, Crises and Turmoil at the New York Times. And many people on the right dismiss the New York Times as biased. I was wondering if that view had any merit.
Well, I think that there's something called Okrent's Law, which I like. Dan Okrent, who I actually know, is the first public editor. And sometimes some things are actually true. And we don't have to, for example, the congressman who said that women are raped, don't get impregnated because their body's rejected. That happens to be on my probable. That's false enough. So to run a story, and in fact, the Times did today, which gives some plausibility, or even interviews somebody who thinks the opposite, that can be foolish. In other words, one has to make a judgment, and that the Times used to do that better. That's what's called gatekeeping. Gatekeeping means the newspaper tries to select and arrange what's true. So is the Times biased? The Times has its shortcomings. I think most of the right-wing complaints about the Times, as well as the left-wing, by the way, are somewhat special pleading. I think we need to say two things about that. One is the country the country has drifted more to the right than it's ever been. If Goldwater were alive today, he'd probably be left of center in the Republican Party because he was a libertarian. And number two, and this is a very important thing, there's been a widening distinction between the major media and the administration. People like the Alsops, who are famous columnists, and Lipman, and Arthur Kroc and James Reston were called in by the president and told what thing they were basically in a complicit relationship. Since the Cuban Missile Crisis, a gap has developed between the administration, whatever it is, and the media, and particularly the major media like the New York Times. That is a vacillating distance. It's much greater, certainly, in Republican administrations now than it was in than it is in Democratic administrations. But it's worth noting that the New York Times was very instrumental in drafting Eisenhower for the presidency. They didn't care if he was a Republican or a Democrat. In other words, so the idea that they're sort of a left-wing media, I reject.
Well, you touched upon this earlier, but it's certainly the case that papers across the country are struggling financially, and the effect of the internet, both as a competitor and also as a new outlet for newspapers, is playing a big role in those struggles. So is there a particular way in which the Times has approached the internet?
Well, we should say several things about that. A, the Times is now has a paywall, so that you have to use the internet, you're supposed to pay a certain amount, unless you're a subscriber, and they get it for free. I figured some years that may change, too. And they have over 500,000 people now subscribing. That sounds good. But there's still a problem there, because people reading on the internet don't spend as much time with the newspaper as readers, even the people who subscribe. The other problem with the paywall, which we'll just add as a parenthesis, is there seems to be ways to sneak through by using, originally it was 20 a month you could get for free. Now it's 10. They can cut it to zero, but they can't cut it much lower than zero. What's going to happen, and what can happen is people use different browsers to break in, and the kids seem to have ways of cracking this, but maybe that will change. But the important thing is that print advertising is more expensive than internet advertising. And print advertising was what used to pay the bills and still pays more than half the bills, by the way. It's still a major source of the advertising revenue. Why? Well, because people pay more. But what's the problem is that it's dropping because many of the department stores in New York used to take double pages every day. They don't do that. There's been some consolidation of the stores. There's no Abraham and Strauss, for example. But also, they don't think the newspaper advertising is worth it now. And in fact, if you put up a paywall, that doesn't increase it as much as you would think, because they had 17 million hits at one time. And now they're going to get less, 17 million monthly hits. So the one objection to remember they had a thing called Time Select at one time. One reason they did away with that is advertisers objected. But here's the basic problem. Internet advertising doesn't compensate for lost print advertising. Also, another thing about internet advertising is those 500,000 people don't call their family over. It's not passed around. Like when you're reading on the internet and your wife is in a different room, you don't say, come look at this ad, the way people did with print advertising. But finally, the problem with internet advertising and why it is cheap is when you go to you see an ad for Marriott on the New York Times site, you don't go there. You go to the main site. They're competing. Every ad on the internet virtually is competing with itself, and there's a better source. This is something almost nobody ever notes, but this is one reason it's worth less. Not worthless, but worth less, okay? And also, the Times is not getting the revenue it needs, and that's one reason it needs to sell some of its products differently. I mean, they're desperate. They're flailing around they have Times Talks, and they sell. They have a Times Wine Club. They're flailing around for revenue sources. The stock has dropped from the low 50s to actually as low as the it's in the single digits now. Now it's jumped up from this year from 6 to 9 because the stock market's doing well. But Facebook, which has of course had a terrible stock disaster, is capitalized at 35 times. In other words, the stock price plus the number of shares of Facebook, which is perceived of as a disaster, is worth 35 times what the Times is today. So the Times, and what else has happened, is they've cut the dividend to zero. So this is actually, why is this important? Well, for one thing, it's a threat to the Times, because the Times, all of the people who are listening to this and own mutual funds own the A shares. And the A shares vote for the board of directors, and they elect, say, 5 of 13. It varies sometimes the number, but that percentage is good. The B shares, which are held by the New York Times and basically by the Sulzbergers family, they vote for the rest of the board of directors. That's why the Times can't be sold so easily to Murdoch or somebody. But on the other hand, this family's getting no dividends. Many of them are not super rich. And the value of their biggest investment has dropped dramatically from the low 50s to 9 without dividends. So one can imagine a time when this, it's called the trust, the family trust would be, some parts of it would begin to bicker with other parts and it might break up. And in that case, somebody might buy the Times. I mean, they'd blow the place up before they'd sell it to Murdoch. But Bloomberg is somebody who, for him, $1 billion or Buffett is nothing. I mean, the capitalization is like $1.35 billion today. And that is not a lot of money, believe it or not, to the handful of very rich people.
In case you just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations, and I'm speaking with Dan Schwartz, the author of End Times, a book about the recent trials and tribulations of the New York Times. You conducted a lot of in-person interviews for this book, and you interviewed a lot of the very top people at the Times. I was curious to know, is there one interview that had the greatest impact on you personally and that has stuck with you?
Well, I remember Arthur Gelb, the ex-managing editor, during a period when they were starting to have major financial problems. He said to me, echoing Watergate, "Follow the money." So that, also, I mean, Arthur Sulzberger, the publisher since 1992, the Arthur Sulzberger Jr., that he said, "We're going to survive no matter what," as also stuck with me. I mean, he could see the storm coming. And so those are some of the interviews that stick out with me. Jonathan Landsman, who was like deputy managing editor, fourth in on the masthead, was extremely helpful. Helped me get some interviews and was always very open about what was really going on there. So I was grateful for him.
And your book is about the Times, but as you've discussed already, the issues that the Times have faced obviously cut across newspapers more generally.
Absolutely.
And I know that you're a close observer of the Post Standard. How would you characterize its last 10 years?
Well, the Post Standard is very fortunate to have an extremely capable editor in the person of Mike Connor, as well as a very strong editor of its Sunday supplement Stars in the person of Peter Schaefer. And I think this Post Standard is really a quality newspaper. I think it's one of the better newspapers in New York State. I don't say that just because I write travel journalism for them. I think they do a very good job of reporting and with the resources they have, which is obviously not the resources of the New York Times. But
and they've cut back a lot.
Cut back a lot. But I mean, I think you can be proud of it. Of the Syracuse paper, which of course they're under financial strain, and who knows what's going to happen in the future. But I think it is a quality paper for a regional paper. I mean, you know, they don't report foreign news, and I don't know the demography of the staff, but a lot of my young students at Cornell go out and they become senior reporters in 2 years for these newspapers. As I've said in the past, you know, anybody can go out and interview Ron Paul in Iowa. My students could do that. And it's not the same as risking your life, you know, in Syria. But I think they do pretty well with cultural news. And obviously, they can't do the investigatory journalism that a major paper can, but I would rank it pretty high. I mean, New York State is pretty lucky. I mean, the Rochester Democrat is pretty good, the Albany Times Union. I mean, but obviously, there's going to be a time, probably before the New York Times folds, where they're going to deliver a paper 3 days a week, and or possibly, like some papers, go on the internet entirely.
Let me get to the three questions at the end. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
I'm 71 years old, and I've had a very fortunate year to publish this book. So I would say, except for the lack of youth, these are very wonderful times in my life, and I've been very fortunate. I'm still teaching at Cornell. I love teaching. So I would say, for me, although I think of myself as still in my prime in terms of joy and travel and ability to function. But obviously, at 71, one is always has to look in the eye, aging and the final chapter. But I don't feel I'm there now.
Second, what's your worst trait?
Well, I would say my wife would say impatience. And I would say my worst trait might be my best trait, which is incredible curiosity.
And third, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
Well, a book in my honor was published this year called Reading Text, Reading Lives, in which there are an overgenerous introduction and an overgenerous citing of me. And, of course, that just happened in July, so obviously it's called a Festschrift or a book, and obviously that's been very exciting. But the Weiss Presidential Fellow really speaks so much to my teaching and the White and to my research, and I've always sort of strived for that balance, so that's really fine. And I guess my family is an achievement. I mean, my children are doing well and are functioning and contributing to the community. And so I guess some pride in children and spouse.
That was Dan Schwartz. And the book is End Times, Crises and Turmoil at the New York Times, 1999 to 2009. Dan, thanks so much for talking with me.
Well, it was a great pleasure, Grant, being on your wonderful show.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.